It is Friday, the 2nd of October, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, Russia continues its airstrikes in Syria. However, there is now the possibility of an expanded ground war. We'll talk with both Mohammed El-Shadawi and Jeff Seldon about that. There's been another mass murder in the United States, one that has reignited the battle over gun control. Today, you'll hear from one of those who do not want more gun control laws.
We have 300 million guns, more than that, in the United States. If you tried a mass confiscation like that, you'd start a civil war.
We will ask him why, and we will also see what is trending on social media. It's all ahead. We start out what's happening in Syria and the new player involved, or at least the increased player involved, that being Russia. Russia carried out more airstrikes in Syria Friday as a U.S.-led coalition urged Moscow to halt any attacks on the Syrian opposition and focus on Islamic State targets. The Kremlin has acknowledged that it was taking aim at what they called a list of groups chosen in coordination with the armed forces of Syria. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said carrying out indiscriminate military operations against the Syrian opposition is dangerous for Russia. Well, International Edition senior Middle East correspondent Mohammed El-Shadawi spoke with Edmond Gharib, professor of Middle East history at the American University, about the repercussions of the Soviet military involvement in the Syrian conflict. Mohammed, how could the Russian military support for the Assad regime change the whole balance in the Syrian conflict?
Well, Ira, apparently Russian military adopted Assad's definition of putting all opposition fighters in the same category with ISIS in a list of terrorist groups, which would eventually put the Syrian opposition in a weaker position, according to Professor Gharib.
The Russians have clearly been saying for a long time that they support the regime, that they believe that there should be an effort by all parties who are opposed to terrorism to work together. They had also reached out to some opposition groups in the last few months of to see if there could be also a new opposition group that would be willing to work with the international community, with the Russians, and also to negotiate with the Syrian government to bring about some changes. But that apparently did not work. And that may have been one of the reasons why the Russians decided that, especially after some of the setbacks that the regime faced in the east and in the north, that they had to back the regime.
Now, some news reports are saying that hundreds of Iranian troops are newly arrived in Syria, and they're going to join in a major ground operation with Assad's government forces. That would complicate things in the Syrian conflict, would it not?
That's yet to be confirmed, Ira. At a Pentagon news conference Thursday, spokesman Colonel Steve Warren did not confirm reports that Iranian troops had crossed into Syria. But he said, it's no surprise to us that Iranians are present. However, Professor Gharib explains how such development could produce a very negative impact into the Syrian crisis.
If we begin to see Iranian forces on the ground, this is likely to contribute in the same way that the introduction of hardline Sunni Islamist groups to increase sectarian fighting in Syria, and this has been one of the main problems that Syria has faced and is facing now. The danger in Syria is that this war has moved away from being, let's say, if you want, at least in the early phase, may have been an uprising against a dictatorial or authoritarian regime, to later a civil war inside the country. And then very quickly, actually, I would say even in the beginning almost, this became sort of a sectarian conflict, and also it became a war by proxy, where different parties, regional parties, as well as an international party, supporting different sides on the ground in Syria. If this continues, and or if the regime collapses, we're likely to see millions of Syrians leave the country with unknown consequences for the regional countries as well as for Europe.
Professor Gharib concluded that the Russian military involvement in Syria is even changing a long-standing American-Saudi stance with regard to the future role of President Assad in the future of Syria. He said the position now is moving toward a limited role for Assad in the early stages of transition, if it ever became a reality.
Now, once again, thank you, Mohammed, for bringing this insight into this story.
Thank you.
Joining us also in studio now is VOA's Jeff Selden. Jeff, among the many interesting points brought up by Mohammed and his guest was the Iranian troop story. Again, not confirmed. What do you hear about it so far?
What I'm hearing from my intelligence sources, military sources, is that it's very likely that there was an influx of about 200 Iranian troops into Syria over the past 7 to 10 days. But as the Pentagon said just yesterday, the Iranians have been there for a long time. If you look at the relationships that have been evolved and what's been keeping the government of President Bashar al-Assad going, there are two main components, or maybe two and a half. One is the Russians. Syria's always been a Russian client state, and Russia, even before it sent in its troops, before it sent in its planes and started carrying out bombing missions, its air campaign, had been sending constantly supplies and arms to prop up the Assad regime. The other player that had played a big role was Iran. And so, as the Pentagon said, look, the Iranians have been there from day one. The other group in there is the Iranian proxy terror group, Hezbollah, which had also put in quite a number of resources to help prop up the Assad regime. So the fact that the Iranians are there is no surprise to anyone. The question is, what exactly will they do and how perhaps are they coordinating with the Russians?
Well, with only 200 people, it's not going to be a conventional warfare where you see lines of troops moving through Syria, right?
Right, and that's not how the Iranians would operate anyway, even from what military intelligence officials have seen from how the Iranians operate in Iraq. What they're likely doing is they're sending in some very highly trained, very effective forces, special forces, who can not only train Syrians or retrain some of the Syrians, but can help direct them and really act as force multipliers. So you spread them out. They are able to take over, take the lead of some of the Syrian battalions, and perhaps the Syrian battalions, along with the new weaponry that's coming from Russia, start making a larger impact on the ground.
Jeff, as always, thanks for being with us. That is VOA's Jeff Selden joining us as we continue to look in this ever-changing story now as Russia starts a bombing campaign, possibility of Iranian troops coming into Syria, probably already there, as Jeff just said. This is going to change probably moment by moment.
Absolutely.
Jeff Selden. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending today. I take it that Russia and Syria might be. What else is going on?
They are, absolutely. They're trending topics. There was a video, actually, the VOA got in that's becoming a little bit of a viral video showing as rescuers were helping people, helping the wounded from an airstrike. They were hit by another airstrike, and you hear this amazing boom, and you see the smoke fly up and people running. So that's been a trending thing for sure. Here in the U.S., it's this shooting in Oregon, the U.S. state of Oregon, that's left 9 students dead at a community college. But the interesting thing is all through this morning, what was trending was not the gunman or not any of his information. There's actually the term "forget Oregon's gunman." And there's this push to not focus on the perpetrator of this crime, but the people, the victims, and the heroes. One of them is Chris Mintz. He's actually trending. His name is trending. He's an Army veteran. He's 30 years old. Shot 5 times as he was approaching the shooter, trying to stop him from this rampage, and lost his life in the process, but trying to save other people, so people citing his heroic actions. And it's nice to see social media praising that rather than focusing on the gunman, which a lot of times is what happens. They focus on the perpetrators, but not the heroes and the heroism.
Well, if you haven't heard, if you're listening to this now, the police chief in that area has refused to even utter the name of the perpetrator in this. And I think that all fits in, doesn't it?
And this is what happened after the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, in a church there. that was kind of the movement at that point, people saying, don't focus on the gunmen, focus on the victims, focus on their stories. So it's nice to see social media embracing their heroism and their lives rather than the life of the gunmen.
And we're going to talk later on in this program to a man who is against any kind of increased gun control, and he represents a good portion of the U.S. population. I think you'll find it interesting. You might not agree with it, but we will play it for you, and you'll hear it. What else got to...
Well, it's Friday, and I know in here in D.C. it's kind of gloomy and dreary outside, raining, cold, so we'll try to end with something positive. There's a new study out that analyzed 19 million tweets from back in September of 2014 through this year, and they found that negative information tends to spread faster than positive information, but the positive information actually was shared more and ultimately reached a larger audience. So they're saying that it's actually positivity that spreads on social media. Social media can be a force for good and actually spread nice things instead of negativity, instead of cyberbullying. People are posting happy thoughts and that kind of stuff.
You didn't just make that up just to...
No, they did the study. They did a study on Twitter and Facebook as well. They said it's the same thing. Now, of course, that being said, it goes back and you see people posting their vacation photos and that makes people depressed. So it's, you know, it's back and forth, but some positive news anyway.
With a happy face, that's Andrew Palcheski, our social media editor, and this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
King crabs, with their sweet snow-white meat, are one of the most popular seafood delicacies. But a new study provides evidence that king crabs, which are high-level predators, may soon be looking for new sources of food themselves and could bring havoc to the Antarctic ecosystem. King crab populations currently live in deep but warm waters adjacent to the Antarctic's continental shelf. But the increasingly warmer waters of that shelf that host an abundant food supply could encourage the king crabs to move in. Continental shelf creatures have evolved without these aggressive shell-crushing predators to bother them. But if the king crabs were to move en masse into their underwater neighborhood, their ecosystem could become radically restructured, and the lives of these native organisms could be in serious jeopardy. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We continue on International Edition. Witnesses to the shooting rampage that killed 9 people at a community college in the northwest U.S. state of Oregon Thursday say the shooter was targeting Christians. Officials say the heavily armed shooter entered classrooms at the Umpqua Community College at mid-morning and began shooting people before dying of a gunshot himself during a shootout with police. At least 2 witnesses' accounts say the shooter, who has not been named by law enforcement officials at least, asked his victims if they were Christian before he shot them. An angry U.S. President Barack Obama responded to the shooting within hours, appearing on television demanding that the American people push Congress to pass what he called common sense gun laws. He said the majority of Americans, including law-abiding gun owners, want tougher gun laws. He said Americans have become numb to what has become routine in the United States, a mass shooting followed by his White House statements and the response by those who oppose more gun control. He said the argument that more guns make people safer cannot be made with a straight face.
We spend over $1 trillion and pass countless laws and devote entire agencies to preventing terrorist attacks on our soil, and rightfully so. And yet, we have a Congress that explicitly blocks us from even collecting data on how we could potentially reduce gun deaths.
I now ask that question to David Coppell. He is with the Cato Institute, also with the Independence Institute, and an adjunct professor of constitutional law at Denver University. He joins us on International Edition. David, thanks for being with us. What about that question the president asked? How can this be?
He's asking the question because he apparently hasn't learned the facts. There is no law in the United States that prevents social scientists, including those getting government subsidies, from doing studies on how to reduce gun crime. And again, on this issue, as he has so often, he is being highly emotional, uninformed, and dishonest. I will say the one piece of honesty that slipped through was after he campaigned for president twice, absolutely assuring people that he did not want to take anyone's guns away. Now he comes out and says what Great Britain and Australia did is the right example. Well, they did mass confiscation of firearms. We have 300 million guns, more than that, in the United States. If you tried a mass confiscation like that, you'd start a civil war.
Why do you say taking people's guns away would start a civil war? As you said, that's been done in other countries. It hasn't started civil wars, especially in countries like Australia, like Great Britain. It hasn't started a civil war. Why people would want to know would it start a civil war here?
Because the last time it was tried was in 1775 and 1776, when the British government in London, in a great political dispute with the American colonies over taxes, freedom of religion, and other issues, began plans to disarm the American public. And when those plans went to the next step, with the British Army being sent out to confiscate guns from people's homes, that was the battles of Lexington and Concord. And that political dispute turned into an 8-year Revolutionary War. And the Americans are well aware that the reason they won that Revolutionary War was because they were well-armed and had their own firearms.
But, David, that's 300-something years ago. Things have changed, have they not?
300 years of global history have confirmed the view of the American people and the American founders that disarmament imposed by government is highly dangerous. Every genocide in the last century, where more than 200 million people have been murdered by their governments, was preceded by the government systematically disarming the intended victims of the genocide. That's true for Hitler, for Stalin, for Mao, for the Pol Pot, for Idi Amin, and on and on and on.
David Coppell is with the Cato Institute. He is a law professor at Denver University and also a researcher at the Independence Institute. David, I believe that a lot of people would want to know the other side of the story that's being presented on this, and I thank you very much for presenting it.
Thank you for having me.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. New York City is going to be the site of a special country music concert to honor women. VOA's Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong recently joined International Edition Sarah Williams to preview the event.
Well, Nikki, there's some big plans coming up involving women in country music. You've got three stars, Martina McBride, Cassidy Pope, and Ray Lynn, are all getting together to celebrate women in country music.
Yes, this is a great event. It's presented by Pandora. It's called Pandora Presents Women in Country Music. And it's really to celebrate women in country and amplify their power and their reach. Also, this event, which occurs in New York, October 14th, is also to help benefit the T.J. Martell Foundation and its breast cancer research.
Very important for women.
Exactly. And even it's important on two levels, because there was this whole controversy called Tomato Gate, in which a radio consultant, very influential, said that women in country music are like garnishes. They're like tomatoes in a salad. They aren't the meat and potatoes of country. And there was a big outcry against that, because so many women have contributed so much to country music. And if you're having a consultant say that and influencing what people are playing, then it's dangerous for women artists. They're not perceived as valuable. They're not going to get as much support, as much promotion. They may not get the best songwriters. And so a lot of artists have spoken out about that. And Pandora is standing up, which I think is interesting, because he was a radio consultant for terrestrial radio, as we call it, or regular radio, commercial radio. And here is a streaming service that's saying, you know what, these women stream very high, have high streaming rates on Pandora, and we're going to stand up with them, not just to celebrate women in country music, but at the same time use it as a means to help women who are struggling with breast cancer.
And I think it's interesting this is taking place in New York, not, say, in Nashville.
Yes, that is interesting. I think that has to do with Pandora.
Okay.
Not so much about the women, but Pandora.
But still, there are people not just in throughout this country, but around the world that just love country music.
Exactly. I mean, New York has its own country music station. So it's not like it's being misplaced per se, but it's going to be an awesome, it's an exciting event, and I'm happy that it's happening. It's happening.
Tell me about the artists performing.
Okay, well, you have Martina McBride. And this is interesting because Martina, out of the three women, she's the established heavy-hitting veteran. So she's the multiple award winner. She's the head of the pack. And then you have Cassidy Pope, who's an artist on the rise. She's a star on the rise. She's the first female winner of The Voice, and she just released her second album. And then there's Ray Lynn, who released an EP. So she's the rookie out of the three of them. She's also a contestant on The Voice and has been signed to a major record label and is just starting to carve out her country music career. So you have three very different women who are at different stages of their career in country music, and they're celebrating all three of them at the particular stage they're in, which is great.
Well, this reminder, you can catch up with Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can reach her on Twitter at VOA underscore music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks so much, Nikki.
And that is our program for today. Why don't you visit our website, please, at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over seven decades, the United Nations has forged a system of international rules and norms that is better, stronger, and more stable than anything that came before it. It is this international order that has underwritten unparalleled advances in human liberty and prosperity, said President Barack Obama in his remarks to the United Nations General Assembly on September 28th. However, some nations see fit to contravene international law. They justify their behavior by claiming that the UN ideals are unachievable, antiquated. In their view, order must be maintained by force if necessary. The rights of individuals are irrelevant. But history shows that regimes who fear their own people will eventually crumble, but strong institutions built on the consent of the governed endure long after any one individual is gone, said President Obama. Indeed, the international community must improve its collective capacity to establish security where order has broken down, and to support those who seek a just and lasting peace. Together, we must protect the powerless, said President Obama. But we can do much more.
Helping people who've been pushed to the margins of our world is not mere charity. It is a matter of collective security. And the purpose of this institution is not merely to avoid conflict, it is to galvanize the collective action that makes life better on this planet.
Working together, we can roll back preventable disease and end the scourge of HIV/AIDS. We can eliminate pandemics that recognize no borders, eradicate extreme poverty, erase barriers to opportunity. And we must pursue inclusive democracy, because countries are stronger when people govern themselves. History is littered with the failure of false prophets and fallen empires who believed that might always makes right, said President Obama. But we are called upon to offer a different type of leadership, leadership strong enough to recognize that nations share common interests and people share a common humanity. We must call on member states to work together more closely under the UN framework. All members should support the ongoing efforts of the special envoys to forge political consensus, buttress essential peacekeeping endeavors, and utilize the full range of conflict prevention tools. Working together, we can assure a brighter and more peaceful future for our world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.